Welcome to the debate. When navigating a vast and dangerous ocean, there are essentially two philosophies of survival.
Right.
The first is to build this massive, highly engineered, structurally impenetrable dreadnought. Everyone gets on board, they follow the captain's orders, and the sheer unity and mass of the ship allow it to just, you know, punch through any hurricane.
Right. It's safe, it's highly coordinated. But, I mean, it requires absolute submission to the chain of command. If the captain steers you into an iceberg, the whole ship goes down.
Exactly. But the second philosophy is to deploy a fleet of small, nimble, autonomous boats. Each captain has their own compass, their own charts, and they navigate the storm individually, trusting that they are all following the same North Star, even if they take slightly different routes.
And the danger there is that some boats might drift off course. But the beauty of that model is that no single mutiny or, you know, bad captain can sink the entire fleet.
Today we are examining the profound tension between centralized religious authority and individual Christian liberty. We are focusing specifically on the historical schism that occurred in the early 20th century between the modern Jehovah's Witnesses and the Bible Students movement.
A massive schism, really.
Oh, absolutely. And my position today is simple. To survive the theological and moral chaos of the modern world, this movement had to build a fortified ark. A unified, centralized organization operating under a singular governing body is absolutely essential for doctrinal purity and global unity.
And my perspective is that decentralized control was never the original design. It represents a dictatorial usurpation of the movement's foundational mandate, which prioritized congregational autonomy, individual Christian conscience, and, going back to your metaphor, a decentralized fleet of believers.
Let me lay out the framework for why centralization is not just practical, but theologically necessary. When you look at the broad scope of Christian history, fragmentation is the rule. It's not the exception.
Yeah, that's true.
The consolidation of authority within the Jehovah's Witnesses was a necessary protective measure for a global faith. I mean, consider Protestantism, which is splintered into tens of thousands of denominations.
Sure, but
each claiming to have the truth, right, while contradicting the others on fundamental issues. In contrast, the Jehovah's Witnesses have maintained a fiercely united global brotherhood. I argue that the strict disciplinary frameworks and the demand for doctrinal unity we see today are not about human control, that they are about uncompromising obedience to Christ. To survive, the faithful need that dreadnought, guided by a unified, singular channel of truth.
But we have to ask what was sacrificed to build that dreadnought. If we look back at Charles Taze Russell, the founder of the movement, the evidence overwhelmingly shows he never intended the Watchtower to govern its members.
Well, he founded it to provide direction.
Direction, yes. But from its inception in 1877 until his death in 1916, it was simply a publishing house and a lecture service. It provided resources. It did not issue decrees.
Right, but the context, it
true Christian liberty in that early model meant that local ecclesias, which is just the Greek word for the individual congregations, independently elected their own elders. They made their own theological and disciplinary decisions based on their collective conscience. The structural shift that occurred under J.F. Rutherford in the decades following Russell's death substituted centralized control for what the early Bible students called individual character development.
I see why you emphasize that.
It inappropriately elevated a human organization to the role of a mediator between the individual and God.
To truly evaluate the legitimacy of the current centralized structure, we have to look at that exact historical pivot. The transition between the 1910s and the 1930s is where the blueprint meets the evolution. You frame Rutherford's actions following Russell's death as a usurpation.
Because it was.
But historically and sociologically, religious movements face an existential crisis when their charismatic founder dies. Max Weber famously called this the routinization of charisma.
Right. The idea that a fluid, spirit-led movement eventually has to develop an HR department and a rule book to outlive its founder.
Precisely. Russell was a towering figure. He held the movement together through his sheer output and his personal magnetism. When he died in 1916, the movement was incredibly fragile. A loose affiliation of autonomous ecclesias was highly susceptible to fragmentation.
Susceptible, sure, but not doomed.
I'd argue it was doomed without change.
If every congregation votes on its own elders, and by extension, its own theological leanings, you inevitably get doctrinal drift. One congregation starts drifting back toward Orthodox Protestantism, another drifts into eccentric prophetic speculation. Without structural hardening, a global religion cannot survive. It would have dissolved into dozens of insignificant localized study groups, constantly bickering over minor doctrinal interpretations.
I understand the sociological argument for institutionalizing. I really do. But there is a profound difference between creating infrastructure to survive and subverting the core theology of a movement to consolidate dictatorial power.
I wouldn't call it dictatorial.
Well, Rutherford didn't just build a wall to protect the flock. He changed the locks and declared himself the only one with the key. Let's look closely at exactly how that happened. The transition of power was not a seamless passing of the baton. It was a hostile corporate takeover utilizing legal loopholes.
You're referring to the events of 1917 with the board of directors.
Yes. We have to unpack this because it is the exact moment the dreadnought was commissioned. Russell left a specific will outlining how the publishing society should be run by an editorial committee, explicitly to prevent one man from seizing total control.
Right.
In 1917, four members of the board of directors, J.D. Wright, A.I. Ritchie, I.F. Hoskins, and R.H. Hirsch, men appointed by Russell himself, pushed back against Rutherford's increasingly autocratic behavior as the newly elected president. How did Rutherford respond?
He took decisive action.
He didn't engage them in a theological debate or call for a congregational vote. He used a legal technicality. He discovered that these four men, while appointed by Russell, had not been formally confirmed by a vote at the latest annual corporation meeting. So he unilaterally fired them. He essentially used a corporate bylaw to override the founder's intent and purge his opposition.
Wait, let me stop you there because framing it merely as a legal technicality ignores the reality of what Rutherford was facing. Those board members were attempting to strip the presidency of its executive power.
They were trying to enforce Russell's will.
They were challenging his legal authority as the elected president of the corporation. Rutherford didn't fire them out of sheer malice. He fired them because you cannot steer a ship through a storm if half the officers on the bridge are actively trying to wrest the wheel away from the captain. But it wasn't supposed to be his ship to steer alone. They were paralyzing the preaching work. Rutherford sought a legal opinion from an outside firm, and they confirmed he had the right to act. He was protecting the legal and operational integrity of the society.
But protecting a corporation is not the same as protecting a spiritual brotherhood. On July 27, 1917, those ousted board members published a letter to the Bible students warning of exactly this. They explicitly warned that the Spirit of the Lord was being replaced by the spirit of domination. And the brethren saw this happening.
Some did, yes.
That's why an estimated 75% of the early Bible students eventually left the Watchtower Society's orbit over the next decade.
That's a high estimate, but yes, a significant number left.
They didn't leave because they lost their faith in God. They left because they refused to submit to a spiritual autocracy. Let's look at the Chicago Bible students. In 1933, they explicitly broke away. An eyewitness, Irving Cross Foss, an elder of the Chicago Ecclesia, documented how Rutherford was systematically removing the democratic process of congregations electing their own elders, replacing it with top-down appointments from Brooklyn.
I see why you emphasize the loss of local elections, but let's explore why those top-down appointments became necessary. The 1933 Chicago split actually proves Rutherford's point that central authority was needed to prevent splinter sects.
How so? It was the central authority that drove them away.
Because when a local congregation is entirely autonomous, it becomes an echo chamber for whoever is the most charismatic speaker in that specific room. The mandate of the Christian congregation, as modeled in the first century, was global unity. The Apostle Paul repeatedly urged the early Christians to speak in agreement and not have divisions.
True, but
you cannot have that level of global agreement across continents and cultures without a centralized mechanism to resolve disputes and set the standard.
But the early Christian model you reference wasn't a corporate hierarchy. Even the Council of Jerusalem in Acts 15, which is almost always cited to justify centralized power today, operated more as a resource of wise counsel resolving a specific cultural dispute about circumcision.
It issued a decree.
It was not a permanent standing dictatorial board in Jerusalem, demanding unquestioning compliance on every facet of daily life in Antioch or Corinth.
Yet the decree from Jerusalem in Acts 15 was delivered to the congregations to be observed. It wasn't a gentle suggestion, it was a doctrinal standard. And let's talk about how Rutherford forged that necessary unity. You mentioned the mass exodus of the original Bible students. Yes, many left, but those who remained needed a distinct identity.
Right.
That is why the 1931 name change to Jehovah's Witnesses at the Columbus, Ohio Convention was such a brilliant and crucial step.
Brilliant from a structural control standpoint, absolutely.
It was brilliant because it created an immediate linguistic and theological boundary. You were no longer just a Bible student, a generic term that dozens of splinter groups were still using. You carried a specific, biblically rooted identity drawn from Isaiah 43, "You are my witnesses."
It definitely drew a line in the sand.
Exactly. It instantly unified those loyal to the centralized preaching work and separated them from the fragmented groups. It gave them a banner to rally under, right as the world was descending into the incredible darkness of the 1930s and 40s. Without that tight organization and clear identity, they would not have survived the intense global persecution they were about to face.
But look at the mechanism of that survival. When a centralized authority strips local congregations of their autonomy, under the guise of protection and unity, it usually means protection of the leadership's power, not the spiritual health of the flock.
I disagree with that characterization.
This historical consolidation of power under Rutherford required a massive theological justification. He couldn't just say to the millions of readers, "Hey, I'm in charge because I hold the legal rights to the publishing company." He had to mandate compliance spiritually, and this leads us directly to the evolving doctrine of the faithful and discreet slave. This is where the organizational pivot transitions into a deeply profound theological issue.
And it is a theological issue that I argue is deeply supported by scriptural interpretation. If we accept the premise that a unified body needs a single compass, we have to look at how Christ promised to guide his followers. The concept of the faithful and discreet slave is drawn directly from Jesus' parable in Matthew 24, 45-47.
Right, where he asks who the faithful slave is.
Yes, he asks, "Who really is the faithful and discreet slave whom his master appointed over his domestics to give them their food at the proper time?" For the global organization to function, there must be a mechanism for dispensing that spiritual food, the doctrinal interpretations, and practical guidance.
Which historically meant all spirit-anointed Christians on earth.
Historically, yes, there was ambiguity. But I will proudly defend the new light unveiled at the October 2012 annual meeting and subsequently published in the July 15, 2013 Watchtower Study Edition.
The new light?
Yes, and for our listeners, new light refers to the principle from Proverbs 4:18 that the path of the righteous gets brighter and brighter, meaning God reveals scriptural understanding gradually over time. In 2012, the organization explicitly identified the governing body itself as the faithful and discreet slave. It clarified decades of theological ambiguity. It established that Jesus selected this small, central group in 1919 to dispense truth.
I come at it from a very different way. When you redefine a biblical parable in 2013 to exclusively grant absolute interpretive power to a small, modern committee, and conveniently erase the other characters in that very same parable, aren't you just retrofitting theology to mandate unquestioning compliance?
Erasing what characters?
The evil slave. Let's unpack the history of how this parable has been utilized. In the late 1920s, Rutherford faced that massive schism we just talked about. He labeled the Bible students who left the organization, the ones who wouldn't follow his corporate takeover, as the evil slave class, mentioned later in that same Matthew 24 passage.
He was applying a scriptural principle to those causing division.
He weaponized the parable to demonize his opposition. Fast forward to 2013. The governing body announces their new light, declaring themselves the sole fulfillment of the faithful slave. But what do they do with the evil slave verses? They completely eliminate the evil slave as a distinct historical class. they declare Jesus was only offering a hypothetical warning, not prophesying a real group.
Because the context of the parable supports it as a warning against unfaithfulness, not a prophetic designation of a specific rogue group.
But look at the practical utility of that theological shift. By removing the evil slave as a historical reality, they conveniently erase the history of the early schism from the modern theology. They cement their own absolute authority without peer and without acknowledging the historical challenge to their legitimacy.
It's about clarification, not erasure.
And the language used to enforce this is stunning. You reference earlier publications. The September 15, 2010 Watchtower on page 23 states that members must recognize that by following the lead of the modern-day governing body, they are in fact following their leader, Christ.
Exactly. It removes the guesswork. It provides millions of believers worldwide with absolute confidence that they are receiving pure, unfiltered direction from a singular channel approved by Jehovah.
But equating obedience to a human committee with obedience to Christ has profound psychological implications. When you look at the modern JW songbook, Sing to Jehovah, there are songs that literally sing praise to the governing body.
It's not worship, though.
Praising an earthly committee borders on idolatry. It fundamentally disrespects God by placing fallible men on a pedestal meant only for the divine. It shifts the burden of scriptural interpretation entirely away from the individual.
I think you are fundamentally misinterpreting the nature of that respect. The songs and the literature do not worship the governing body. They express deep gratitude for the channel Jehovah's using.
You mentioned that this shifts the psychological burden of interpretation.
It entirely removes it from the individual.
I agree, it does. And it brings immense peace. The psychological burden of having to individually interpret complex, ancient scriptures, of having to navigate the shifting moral sands of the 21st century alone, is overwhelming for most people. By providing a clear, unified voice, the governing body shifts the burden away from the isolated, fallible individual and onto a collective, spirit-directed body. It's the difference between wandering in a dark forest with a flickering match versus walking on a well-lit highway.
But the Christian calling isn't supposed to be a paved highway where you just put your brain in neutral and follow the car in front of you. The Apostle Paul praised the Bereans in the book of Acts because they examined the scriptures daily to see if the things they were being taught were true.
And the governing body encourages Bible study.
Burden of interpretation entirely to a human committee, you stunt the spiritual growth of the individual. You create an environment of learned helplessness.
It is not learned helplessness to trust a proven guide.
It is when that guide claims absolute authority. Because when that human committee makes a mistake, as all humans do, as their own history of shifting new light proves, the entire global membership is forced to participate in that mistake under threat of expulsion.
That's a very cynical way to view organizational unity.
If a member in 1920 read the Bible and concluded correctly that the ancient patriarchs were not going to physically resurrect in 1925, which Rutherford heavily promoted, that member would be viewed as lacking faith. The elevation of the governing body as the sole channel of truth dictates exactly how individual members are governed, disciplined, and punished on a Tuesday afternoon, which brings us to the practical boundaries of Christian liberty.
If we accept that the dreadnought is necessary for survival, then the boundaries on that ship are necessary to maintain the purity of the crew. The discipline you criticize is not arbitrary. It is biblically mandated.
But the reach of this centralized control has become so extreme that it results in a devastating loss of Christian liberty. Let's look at the reality of JW centralized discipline today. A member can be disfellowshipped, which means total social and familial shunning for reading religious material not published by her governing body.
Well, to protect them from apostasy.
They can be shunned for simply speaking to former members. They can be expelled for celebrating Christmas.
Christmas is steeped in pagan origins.
Yes, but the early Bible students freely observed it. They knew the dates were inaccurate, but they used it as a time to honor Christ. It was a matter of individual conscience until Rutherford abruptly banned it in 1927 and 1928, declaring it supported Satan's organization.
He was cleaning up false religious practices.
It wasn't about
new scriptural insight. It was about further isolating the flock from broader society. Let's look at how this discipline is enforced today. Think about the tragedy of the story published in the 2013 Convention Literature about the J.W. aunt who accused her own nephew of apostasy simply because he was asking honest scriptural questions. The organization praised her for turning him in.
She was protecting her own spirituality from someone sowing doubts.
She was acting as an informant on her own family. And what happens when someone is accused? The 2010 Elder's Manual, Shepherd the Flock of God, outlines judicial committee procedures that are rigid, secretive, and heavily weighted against the accused.
They are designed to bring about repentance.
The individual cannot bring legal counsel, they cannot record the meeting, and the elders act as judge, jury, and executioner of their social life. Consider the incredible experience of Amber Scora, who went to China as a JW missionary. She noted the profound irony in her memoir that it was only when she was isolated from the constant oversight of the congregation, living in an actual totalitarian state where the religion was banned, that she finally found the freedom to think.
That's her personal experience, though.
She could finally read and question without an elder looking over her shoulder. When a religious organization mirrors the thought control mechanisms of a totalitarian regime, we have completely lost the plot of the gospel.
Now, I know listeners hearing about disfellowshipping or the ban on reading certain materials might immediately recoil. To modern secular ears, that sounds incredibly controlling. But we have to look at this through the lens of a biblical immune system.
An immune system?
Yes. Liberty isn't a license for doctrinal chaos. The strict adherence to doctrines and the practice of disfellowshipping isn't about human control. It's about uncompromising obedience to scriptural commands to keep the congregation pure. Let's take the prohibition on blood transfusions.
A prohibition that has cost thousands of lives.
Critics frame the blood issue as the ultimate example of the governing body exerting sadistic control over life and death. But it is fundamentally about strict adherence to Genesis 9.4 and Acts 15, which explicitly command Christians to abstain from blood. The organization doesn't enforce this to be cruel. They enforce it because they genuinely believe it is God's inviolable law. If you're sealing the hull of the dreadnought to survive a hurricane, you can't have individual sailors drilling their own portholes because they want a better view. That's what unchecked Christian liberty looks like to a centralized leadership. It sinks the ship.
But drilling a porthole is a deliberate act of sabotage. Reading a historical commentary on the book of Romans is an act of spiritual curiosity. You are equating the two.
Because unchecked intellectual pride leads to apostasy. When the baptism questions were changed in 1985 to require candidates to explicitly identify their association with the Spirit-directed organization, rather than just dedicating themselves to God and Christ, it was a necessary immune system response. The world is awash in moral relativism and spiritual decay.
So the organization becomes the savior?
The organization must protect the congregation from the cancer of apostasy. If you have a body and a cancer develops, you don't celebrate the cancer's liberty to grow. You excise it to save the body. Disfellowshipping is the spiritual immune system working exactly as the Apostle Paul instructed when he told the Corinthians to remove the wicked man from among yourselves.
But your immune system metaphor falls apart when the cancer isn't wickedness or immorality, but rather intellectual curiosity or a different in scriptural conscience. In the early days, the Bible students placed a massive emphasis on what they called character development.
Right. Russell talked a lot about that.
The goal of the Christian walk was an internal transformation, developing the fruits of the Spirit, you know, love, joy, peace, patience. J.F. Rutherford explicitly hated this concept. He reportedly mocked the idea of character development from the convention platform, calling it a delusion from Satan.
That's a strong word, hated.
He literally pronounced it mockingly, "Hira tir," and told the audience, "You don't have a character, you are a character."
He was pushing back against self-righteous navel-gazing when there was urgent preaching work to be done.
He was systematically replacing the goal of inward moral excellence with the goal of outward organizational loyalty. He swapped character for compliance.
But does true moral excellence require the freedom to make wrong choices? Absolutely. If I only do the right thing because I am terrified of a secret judicial committee taking away my family and friends, that isn't character. That's compliance under duress.
I think it's obedience to God's arrangement.
True Christian liberty allows the individual to wrestle with God, to study, to sometimes get it wrong, and to grow through grace. A fleet of boats allows each captain to learn the currents. The dreadnought just requires you to swab the deck and ask no questions.
I completely disagree that organizational loyalty and character development are mutually exclusive. In fact, true Christian character is demonstrated precisely through humility and submission to the arrangement God has put in place. It requires immense character to sublimate your own ego, your own brilliant interpretations, and your own desires for the sake of the unity of the global brotherhood.
But at what cost?
The secular world offers absolute freedom, and look at the anxiety, the depression, the moral decay, and the absolute atomization of community it produces.
But the alternative shouldn't be a spiritual panopticon.
And the organization offers boundaries, and within those boundaries, you find true peace. You are freed from the paralyzing paradox of choice. You have the ability to focus entirely on the preaching work, which is the paramount duty of a Christian in these last days. We aren't just debating philosophy or the sociology of group dynamics here. We are talking about the ultimate gatekeeper. The practical application of this discipline ultimately ties into the highest stakes possible. Who survives Armageddon, and what constitutes salvation?
And this is exactly where the theology crosses the line from merely restrictive organizational policy to something spiritually dangerous.
I argue that it crosses the line into absolute necessary clarity. The position of the Jehovah's Witnesses is that the organization is the modern-day Ark. Survival through the impending global destruction of Armageddon is inextricably contingent upon remaining inside the organization and submitting to the direction of the governing body.
Let's define the stakes for the listener. What exactly is the governing body teaching happens at Armageddon?
Armageddon is the biblical war where God will intervene to destroy human political systems and eradicate wickedness from the earth. The theology holds that the great crowd, which is the vast majority of Jehovah's Witnesses today, who hope to live forever on a paradise earth, as described in Revelation 7, must be in full harmony with the earthly leadership to receive those promises.
In full harmony.
Just as Noah's family had to be physically inside the wooden ark to survive the global flood, Christians today must be spiritually and practically inside the bounds of Jehovah's organization. There is no salvation outside of it, because God is a God of order, not of independent, scattered individuals claiming to serve him in their own unique, contradictory ways.
I'm sorry, but I just don't buy that. Let me tell you why. Placing an earthly organization as the absolute binary gatekeeper to surviving Armageddon replaces Jesus Christ as the sole mediator between God and humanity. You swapped the new covenant for a corporate membership card. This represents a massive, tragic theological shift from the foundation C.T. Russell laid.
How so? Russell also believed in Armageddon?
He did, but the early Bible students embraced a theological framework known as ransom for all. For our listeners who might not be familiar with that specific 19th century theology, ransom for all essentially meant that Jesus' sacrifice guaranteed that every human being would get a fair, unblinded opportunity for salvation, either in this life or during a future millennial reign.
A very different view, yes.
They looked at the prophecies and saw a brighter result after Armageddon. They believed in a no one left behind concept. This contrasts sharply with the modern JW view that billions of men, women, and children will be violently and permanently destroyed at Armageddon simply because they didn't distribute Watchtower magazines or happen to be inside the Ark when the end comes.
It is not a publishing corporation. It is the visible part of Jehovah's universal organization. And the concept of the Ark isn't sadistic, as critics often claim. It is profoundly merciful. The warning is being sounded globally right now in hundreds of languages. The fact that the requirement for survival involves association with the organization is simply a reflection of the fact that God has always used a specific identifiable group to accomplish his will, whether it was the nation of Israel in antiquity or the first century Christian congregation.
But the Israelites weren't saved purely by their institutional affiliation. The prophets constantly condemned the institution when it failed morally. Early Brethren in the Bible Student movement relied on personal consecration to Christ. Their salvation was based on grace and the merit of Jesus' sacrifice, not on maintaining good standing with a judicial committee in New York.
The fear of Armageddon, you imply, is not meant to be a paralyzing terror. It is a unifying, motivating urgency. It is the engine driving the greatest, most coordinated volunteer preaching campaign in human history.
But observe how that fear functions psychologically as a unifying tool versus the joy of personal spiritual growth. When salvation is institutional and boundary-based, the primary motivator inevitably becomes fear. It is the fear of stepping out of line, the fear of reading the wrong website, the fear of expressing a legitimate scriptural doubt, the fear of being shunned by your parents.
That's a drastic oversimplification.
The fear of being destroyed like a hot dog at a campfire, as one governing body member famously described the fate of the wicked at Armageddon. It creates an environment of perpetual anxiety.
I think you are projecting an anxiety that doesn't exist for the faithful.
It exists for anyone whose conscience begins to conflict with the leadership. In contrast, a grace-based, individualized salvation model motivates through love and profound gratitude. The early Bible students held conventions where the feeling of freedom and open fellowship was paramount. They could debate scripture openly without fear of a judicial committee hauling them into a back room. When you make an organization the gatekeeper of salvation, you inevitably breed a culture of spiritual paranoia because your standing with God is perpetually mediated by fallible men who have the power to cut you off at any moment. You are trusting the captain of the dreadnought with your eternal life, even when he alters the map.
The anxiety you describe only exists for those who are fighting against the spirit, those who are resisting the clear direction. For the vast majority of active Jehovah's Witnesses, there is immense joy and peace in knowing exactly where they stand. They know they have a global family that will support them anywhere in the world, and they have a clear, unambiguous mission.
At the cost of individual thought.
The ransom for all theology you champion sounds highly comforting, incredibly tolerant, and modern. But it severely dilutes the urgency of the times we live in. If everyone gets a second chance in the millennium, regardless of their actions or associations now, what is the point of the narrow road Jesus spoke about? Why preach at all? The structured boundaries of the organization ensure that the flock stays on that narrow road and accomplishes the work.
We've spent a lot of time exploring this history, and it is a complex tapestry of theology, corporate law, sociology, and human nature.
It is. And the depth of the historical material, the original watchtowers, the July 1917 board member letters, the Chicago Bible Students Archives, really brings these early struggles into sharp focus. To summarize my position, I believe that the historical and theological evidence demonstrates that authentic faith requires the Christian liberty originally envisioned by C.T. Russell.
Mm-hmm.
The shift orchestrated by J.F. Rutherford, utilizing legal loopholes to oust his detractors, was a departure from that blueprint. Centralizing authority, taking away the autonomy of local congregations to elect their own elders, and eventually elevating a human committee to the status of God's sole unquestionable channel, invariably leads to spiritual dictatorship. It replaces individual character development with mere organizational compliance, and it wrongly inserts men into the mediatorial role that belongs exclusively to Christ.
And I will summarize my stance by reiterating that global unity and adherence to scriptural purity simply cannot exist without centralized authority. The evolution from a loosely affiliated, fragile association of Bible students into the highly structured, unified organization of Jehovah's Witnesses was a necessary providential development. It protected the faith from fragmentation and worldly corruption.
That's the dreadnought view.
Yes, exactly. The governing body, functioning as the faithful and discreet slave, provides the essential, unified direction needed to navigate the complexities and moral decay of the modern world. Without this arc, the flock would be scattered, divided, and lost. We certainly acknowledge that both sides of this debate deeply value scriptural truth and share sincere desire to follow Christ.
Absolutely. The points of convergence are real and shouldn't be ignored.
Both movements study the Bible intensely. Both reject many of the orthodox dogmas of mainstream Christendom, like the Trinity or Hellfire, and both seek to honor God with their lives. Our fundamental disagreement lies in whether honoring God requires absolute submission to an earthly organization or whether it relies on the exercise of individual conscience guided by the Holy Spirit.
This discussion highlights the enduring value of examining historical texts. By looking at the letters, the convention records, and the evolving publications, we can truly understand how religious structures adapt, harden, and justify their existence over time. We highly suggest that our listeners explore the historical material provided in the show notes to better understand the deep, complex roots of this issue.
I agree. There is so much more to explore in these archives about how early believers wrestled with exactly these questions of authority, loyalty, and liberty. It's a debate that touches the core of what it means to belong to a faith.
We leave it to you, the listener, to weigh the evidence and form your own conclusion. Consider whether a faith is best preserved by the impenetrable hull of a single, massive dreadnought, moving with absolute unity under one command, or if true spiritual resilience is found in a fleet of small, autonomous boats, each guided by its own compass, trusting the stars. Thank you for joining us.